Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to EMForum.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. For our newcomers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. Now, today we are going to learn about the RAD Resilient City Initiative and the planning aid published by the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Center for Biosecurity earlier this year, the RAD Resilient City Preparedness Checklist. Please see today's background page for links to the document and other related links. Now, first, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation and then proceed to your questions or comments. Now, if you encounter any difficulty with live meeting, you may use the feedback drop-down menu that's at the top right, and then my associates, Ava Jean Moore and Lori Weber, will monitor that and try to assist you via private message. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program, and we also ask you not to send any private messages to the speaker or moderator, as we will be busy with the presentation. We are making recordings, which should be available later this afternoon, and then the text transcript will be posted early next week. Now, if you're not on our mailing list, you can subscribe from our homepage, and then you will get a notice when these materials are ready. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's guest. We are very happy to welcome back Dr. Monica Schock-Spanna, Director of the RAD Resilient City Initiative and Senior Associate with UPMC's Center for Biosecurity. She also serves as Assistant Professor in the School of Medicine Division of Infectious Diseases and on the Faculty and Steering Committee for the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, also known as START. Again, please see today's background page for additional biographical information. Welcome back, Monica. Thank you once again for joining us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's a real pleasure to be back at the EM Forum, and I appreciate this opportunity to brief you on a new initiative that the Center for Biosecurity has recently rolled out and is briefing throughout the country right now. The inspiration for the RAD Resilient City Initiative is the fact that if prevention of nuclear terrorism fails, then reducing exposure to radioactive fallout is the intervention that can save the greatest number of lives following a nuclear detonation. And for those of you who are familiar with the Center for Biosecurity, you'll know that we focus on medical and public health preparedness for catastrophic health events. And it was very illuminating for us to learn that minimizing exposure to radioactive fallout can save the most lives. And this was a proposition that we could not ignore, and hence built the initiative around that finding. The purpose of the RAD Resilient City Initiative is to provide leaders from high terrorism risk localities with a checklist of preparedness actions to help save tens of thousands of lives or more following a nuclear detonation. And again, this is through adequate protection against radioactive fallout. And when we talk about providing a planning tool for leaders, we mean all those people who hold sway and authority in a community. So elected and appointed officials, certainly, and chiefs of public health and safety agencies, but we're also talking about business executives, heads of volunteer and community-based organizations, and other grassroots opinion leaders. This tool was meant to provide a common vision of community preparedness for an unthinkable event, such as a nuclear terrorist attack, and a way forward in terms of life-saving objectives. Just a quick overview of what I'm going to cover today. I want to talk with you about why we saw the checklist as needed today, the type of knowledge that is the background for the checklist and which it is grounded, the myths that the checklist dispels, the actions that the checklist recommends, some tools that we also prepared to help make the checklist doable for jurisdictions throughout the country, and where we see the value added of this checklist for communities around the country. So let's start with the question of why is this checklist needed? There's, of course, the issue of nuclear terrorism, which is a real and urgent threat. And this is an assessment by both the U.S. and other governments, but also independent non-government experts, such as the Nuclear Threat Initiative. So I've put up a few quotes from the last two years from key national leaders, including the President, the Secretary of Defense, and the Director of National Intelligence. President Obama declared at the Nuclear Security Summit that two decades after the end of the Cold War, we face a cruel irony of history. The risk of a nuclear confrontation between nations has gone down, but the risk of nuclear attack has gone up. So the fact that nuclear terrorism is a possibility in today's modern political and technological context cannot be ignored. The reasons for that is that the raw materials exist in the world. Right now, there's enough fissile material in the world to make more than 120,000 crude nuclear devices. At the same time that fissile material exists in the world, and should terrorist groups get their hands on it, there is information that is publicly available to help them make a nuclear weapon. So the technology is readily available. And lastly, we know that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups have stated that they seek and have attempted to acquire nuclear weapons. So it's the materials, the technology, and the motivation that is compelling national leaders such as those we just saw and quoted to worry about the possibility of a nuclear detonation. Now, apart from threat, alongside the threat, that is, we have the fact that most Americans don't know how to protect themselves and their families in the event of a nuclear detonation. And currently, I would say that most local emergency management structures are not necessarily well-equipped to instill knowledge about minimizing fallout exposure, either before the event in terms of pre-event public education or after the event in terms of post-incident public warning messages. But I'd love for us to talk more about what's going on in your respective jurisdictions. So we have a threat, but we have a population that does not know what action is going to help reduce casualties in the presence of that threat. So there has been wonderful guidance emerging that's been supported by the federal government, emerging from the national laboratories. We've got great guidance coming out of radiological professional groups, such as the National Council on Radiation Protection and Measurements. But in the face of all these hundreds of pages of helpful guidance on how states and locals can tackle nuclear preparedness and response, we don't, until presently, we didn't have a clear checklist that communities could follow and see themselves as gaining purchase on this complex problem. And in fact, most local jurisdictions have been on their own to piece together recommendations and chart out a path forward. And so we see the RAD Resilient City Preparedness Checklist as filling a critical planning gap at the local level. I should point out that this project really stands on the shoulders of other people. And I want to underscore that this project was never meant to reinvent the wheel. It was meant to take the emerging federal guidance and technical reports on improvised nuclear device response and produce a user-friendly guide to community preparedness. we have spent, we rolled out the preparedness checklist at the end of September. In the prior year to that rollout, we had convened an expert advisory group, the Nuclear Resilience Expert Advisory Group, to help pull together those key elements of the emerging federal guidance and technical reports. This expert advisory group was a multidisciplinary group that included top experts and leaders from across government, radiation science, communication science, emergency response, and the business, volunteer, and community sectors. We felt that this was such a complex problem, that is preparing communities for the prospect of a nuclear detonation and exposure to fallout, that we had to hear from the best minds from a variety of fields. So, for example, we needed, from the perspective of an emergency manager, what logistical challenges would a phased-in mass evacuation provide after a period of sheltering? We needed the perspective of behavioral and social scientists who know how people engage in behaviors during a period, a process of evacuation, and we needed experts on public warnings about how one communicated in an effective way to people about whether they should shelter in place, and then if at one time they should evacuate the area. So we had to have the emergency manager talk to the public warning expert, talking to the health physicist who knew what challenges were posed in terms of radiation levels and exposure to fallout. So we brought all those people to the table. We also reviewed a number of research studies on community preparedness to find out what were the system capabilities that one needed in place, regardless of hazard, and to support community preparedness. And we also drilled down into a number of local radiation emergency plans. So that there's an extensive practical and technical knowledge base that the checklist emerges from, in addition to those multidisciplinary conversations that we thought were absolutely essential to coming forth with good guidance for jurisdictions. What the checklist does at the outset is dispel a number of myths. The fact is that much of what the U.S. public knows or imagines about nuclear detonations has been shaped in the Cold War context. So we grew up with movies such as The Day After, and then all the science fiction movies about gigantic ants and the like. And other creatures that were morphed by high radiation levels. But what's important to note is that most of our notions about Cold War nuclear detonations do not apply to nuclear terrorism involving a crude device detonated at ground level and producing a low-yield explosion. So the sense that death is certain for all after a detonation is a myth, and that we don't have to be resolved to some preordained number of casualties. We can actually reduce the number of casualties related to radioactive fallout exposure. Why it is that the nuclear detonation scenario does not map onto the nuclear terror scenario, I'll give you some figures. A nuclear scenario modeled in 1985 assumed that 6,559,000 kilotons of explosives detonating at targets throughout the U.S. A true Armageddon-like scenario. Contrast that with the nuclear terrorist threat. Experts now estimate that 10 kilotons would be the approximate yield of a successful entry-level fission bomb made by a terrorist organization. So contrast 6,500,000 kilotons as opposed to 10 kilotons, which Brooke Budemeyer, who's a an expert from the National Laboratories says is comparable to 5,000 Oklahoma City truck bombs, just to give a another type of comparison. So ideas about what constitutes the best protective actions are also or can also be based on false premises. So as I said, this checklist dismantles three misconceptions that really inhibit people from taking action or the correct protective action in the context of a nuclear terrorist attack. We know that death is not certain for all after detonation. New federal modeling, for example, of a 10-kiloton ground burst in Los Angeles suggests that if everyone at risk of exposure to dangerous fallout quickly went into a shallow basement or an equally protective place, then 280,000 lives could be saved. So it is a myth that death is certain for all after detonation. The second myth is that fleeing is the best way to avoid radiation exposure. Now, in theory, getting away as quickly as possible from the destroyed area sounds like a good idea. In actuality, fleeing will result in lives lost. So immediately finding and staying in the most robust shelter will reduce radiation exposure and save lives. Fleeing is the last thing one should be doing post-nuclear detonation. The third myth that the checklist dispels at the beginning is that people must rely on first responders for protection. In fact, people can't wait to be told what to do to protect themselves. The reasons are that fallout is the most dangerous in the first few hours after detonation. And secondly, degraded communications will prevent officials from warning people in the areas that need the information the most. Therefore, pre-educated citizens are what we need to strive for. They can protect themselves. They don't need to wait to be told what to do. And they can't, in fact, rely because of the on being told what to do because of the timeliness of the advice and the fact that there could be degraded communication infrastructure. Now, what actions does the checklist recommend, which is the next point in this briefing? The checklist sets forth seven clear actions for communities to build an integrated fallout preparedness program. When we were putting together the checklist and the various implementation tasks, the expert advisory group made it very clear that we needed to provide a path forward in which priorities were clear to people. Certainly no city or region is capable of immediate success. So what we strive to do was to put actions in order of what should be tackled first and foremost. So in that way, the checklist tries to balance the practical and the perfect. The first action, which won't come as a surprise to all of you, is the need to obtain broad community backing for nuclear event preparedness. Certainly, fallout preparedness is a broad community concern. There is no single entity that can provide this public service. Sound emergency management structures and strategies are absolutely essential. In addition, we also need efforts by businesses, schools, nonprofits, and average citizens around this issue. Also important to remember is that a diverse coalition can help overcome any reticence to plan for an unthinkable event like a nuclear detonation. Going back to the earlier issue about the myths that people tend to hold in their minds around a nuclear terrorist attack, the general reticence to plan for any type of disaster is a problem that we all have to face on a regular basis. But it's complicated by the fact that people think there is absolutely nothing you can do in order to reduce casualties after a nuclear detonation. So that fatalism gets in the way. So it's absolutely important to have a diverse set of stakeholders backing up the importance of nuclear event preparedness. The second main action is conducting pre-event public education to inform people about the effects of a nuclear detonation and how they can protect themselves. In a no-notice nuclear detonation, the public really does need to be empowered beforehand with the knowledge that the most effective action they can take is to find adequate shelter immediately. And as we mentioned, following a detonation, it's going to be difficult or impossible to issue fallout warnings in the areas that most need them due to destruction and disruption of the communication infrastructure. So pre-event public education is a top priority in the checklist. The third action is enabling building owners and operators to assess shelter attributes and to teach others. And when we say building owners and operators, we're talking about everybody from skyscraper managers down to individual householders. Studies in the U.S. have shown that people spend almost 90% of their time in enclosed buildings. 6% is actually enclosed in some type of form, some form of transportation vehicle. So people have a very strong relationship with their built environment. It makes up most of their day. We believe that it's important to raise people's consciousness about the built environment around them. There are institutions already at play in our communities that have a focus on the buildings in which we live, play, and work. Homeowner associations, commercial building owner and manager associations, and we need to work through those institutions and people who have responsibilities for overseeing buildings, that they function as key educators in their communities, that they promulgate shelter rating guides so that tenants of all kinds learn which places provide the most safety. The fourth action is strengthening the ability to deliver public warnings post-incident. Jurisdictions really need to be creative in terms of thinking through how they're going to deliver fallout warnings after detonation, assuming a degraded communication infrastructure. By creative, we're talking about mixing both radio broadcast with text-based messaging and the like, and also low-tech technologies as well. Also critical is to have prescriptive, scientifically-based public messages about protective actions. Communities should not wait until after an incident to decide who should authorize the release of a fallout warning and what it should say. Time delays can result in preventable deaths. Action 5 is establishing a rapid system for mapping and monitoring the dangerous fallout zone. There will be plume models available within from federal sources available within 15 minutes after a nuclear detonation. That's the current planning assumption. But plume models are not going to give you the most accurate reading about radiation levels and its distribution throughout a community. So to know the true fallout footprint, you have to rely on the ground monitoring. Knowing the fallout footprint is going to vastly improve guidance on which residents need to evacuate, how soon, and which routes present the lowest possible dose. So a key point that I really want to underscore is that mapping and communicating where fallout is not a threat is just as important as communicating those people who are located in the dangerous fallout zone. We know that unnecessary evacuation will strain resources for people in high-risk areas, so we need people to stay put if they're not at risk. Action 6 is to develop capabilities to support a large-scale phased evacuation. At a certain point in time, some people are going to need to transition from their protective shelter to a place of greater safety to minimize radiation dose. A large-scale phase evacuation is a very complex undertaking that calls for intense advanced planning. That's because some groups are going to need to leave an area sooner than others, and roads could be obstructed. The seventh action, speaking more broadly about community preparedness in general, is to integrate, test, and conduct training on all the above elements of what we see as a comprehensive preparedness and public warning system relative to fallout. Unless people have a chance to train in the practice, they'll be less likely to perform well when it really matters, which I know all of you are already familiar with. Now, I mentioned earlier that the expert advisory group tried to create a list in such a way that we balance the practical and the perfect. The judgment of the group was that when implementing the checklist, jurisdictions should put their early emphasis in fallout preparedness on pre-event public education. Now, this is a challenging task, but in comparison, for instance, to some of the technological challenges related to radiation monitoring, this is more straightforward, and the reward is immense. The end result of successful pre-event public education would be an informed population capable of acting on its own. And again, what we want people to do is to seek adequate shelter and stay there at least 24 hours, by which time the dangerous exposure levels will have dropped off significantly. And when we spoke as a group about a pre-event public education campaign, we thought about its various components. Certainly, one would need a mass education campaign around key lessons such as how you judge adequate shelter, why stockpiling for at least several days, if not more, is important to support sheltering in place, and why it is safe to take in evacuees from a stricken region. So certainly there are key messages that need to be delivered by a mass education campaign. The group also underscored the importance of a more neighborhood-based training and education program to help seed grassroots conversations about fallout. Certainly there are people already primed in a community who have taken on preparedness as a core objective. These people can be spokespersons about the importance of preparedness for something unthinkable such as nuclear terrorism. And lastly, going back to the issue of building owners and operators being key educators, a successful pre-event public education campaign would broadly distribute a shelter rating guide to both private and public building owners and operators so that they can work with their various constituents to raise the level of awareness about what constitutes adequate shelter in the context of nuclear fallout. On the issue of what tools make the checklist doable, we provided, and as Amy pointed out, it's available online. All these materials are available at no cost online. In the accompanying workbook to the checklist, there were a number of resources to help communities make quick progress on the checklist. And these included, as I noted, a phased implementation plan that breaks down preparedness into manageable and prioritized steps. Secondly, it's a compilation of critical topics that communities can incorporate when designing their own public education campaigns around fallout preparedness, trying to anticipate the topics that people want and need to know in relation to minimizing radiation exposure. A third type of resource is tips on how you write an effective post-detonation fallout warning message, drawing on the communication science about what actually motivates people to take protective actions. There's a strong empirical basis about how one communicates in such a way that people take the protective action that you intend. Also included are sample fallout warning messages that put these tips into action and that also model the public health information that is needed in the minutes, hours, and days following a nuclear detonation. So jurisdictions can take both the sample fallout warning messages and the various public health information scenarios to prepare their own materials. And lastly, there's a listing of frequently asked questions that are targeted to building owners and operators and safety officers for business and schools and neighborhood associations on the best buildings and spaces in which to shelter. I want to conclude with just a few words on what we see as the benefits to communities that adopt the RAD Resilient City Checklist, building on the systems they already have in place. Sheltering is fundamental to fallout preparedness. The ability to shelter in place for at least 24 hours and over a period of several days, perhaps, is absolutely key. It resonates with other hazards that are familiar to you in your own jurisdictions. So we see fallout preparedness not as a far-fetched idea given the protective behavior being sheltering in place. Fallout preparedness helps extend an all-hazards framework so that it becomes truly comprehensive in the ability to address nuclear terrorism. So by using the RAD Resilient City Checklist to see how your current systems measure up for handling fallout preparedness, we believe that people are achieving a more comprehensive approach, a truly all-hazards framework. Another benefit is that there are certain activities that are fundamental for nuclear terrorism readiness, such as the development of public warning protocols about who is authorized to release a warning, and also the cross-sector collaboration that's fundamental to this issue. All of these can have spillover effects in planning for other complex disasters. Given that nuclear terrorism is a hazard that's often put in the too hard to do list, we see that steady implementation of the checklist with clear milestones so people can measure their success in moving forward can help create momentum for tackling other nuclear response and recovery issues like the surge in demand for medical services and the sheltering of mass displaced populations. And of course, it goes without saying that lastly, in the event of an actual nuclear detonation, that tens of thousands of lives could be saved. Let me just include a quick postscript before we turn to the Q&A section of today's forum. I've had questions from a number of people about what the status is of the project. We're currently speaking at a variety of national meetings across the country over the next 12 to 18 months, briefing people on the checklist and the supporting materials available in the workbook. We've already to date spoken at the Big City Emergency Managers Meeting, the National League of Cities Congress and Expo. We were just in Las Vegas at the International Association of Emergency Managers annual meeting and expo. Spoke recently at the National Association for Radiation Readiness. And we're going to a variety of other meetings in the future, the Public Health Preparedness Summit. We're going to the annual meeting of the Building Owners and Managers Association. We'll be addressing the fire chiefs when they're here in Baltimore. We're trying to get on the agenda of the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the National Governors Association meetings. And we will be speaking at the annual meeting of the National Council on Radiation Protection and Measurements. The point I want to make here is we're trying to move out knowledge of the checklist to a variety of practitioners, in addition to elected and appointed officials. We actually this comes up under the reactions that we have gotten with regard to the checklist. People see the checklist as an important guide and help to them. But we've heard from a number of people that nuclear preparedness in response is a politically taboo issue, and it's been very difficult to raise in some communities. This topic is one that people don't want to address lest they be seen as possibly fear-mongering, or lest they appear to know something that the public does not know, that there is some type of imminent threat. We have had the reaction to the checklist is actually two kinds. One is gratitude that we're willing to talk about a taboo issue and at least chart a path forward. And the second is that the checklist is great, but in some context, it's difficult to press nuclear preparedness and response as a legitimate concern for any community. We've also heard that jurisdictions could benefit greatly from the federal government taking a more proactive lead on the public communication challenges around this very difficult topic, that it may not make sense for jurisdictions to do their own pre-event publication initiatives on their own one at a time without some clear national level message coming out of the federal government. The next steps for the initiative is, as I mentioned, continued dissemination through various national meetings and through wonderful communication tools such as the EM Forum. We're in conversation with several entities who are interested in adopting the checklist, and we are talking about how Center for Biosecurity can assist them both on a strategic and on an operational level. So thank you for your attention, and I look forward to your questions and also learning about what's going on in your respective jurisdictions around this issue, whether you two find that it's a politically taboo issue or one that's difficult to move in a period of economic duress and major cutbacks in public institutions and emergency management budgets. So thank you again for your attention, and it's a real pleasure to be here today.
Well, thank you very much, Monica. Now we will proceed to our Q&A. And if you would like to submit a question or a comment, you just click on Q&A from the top menu, and then you'll type your question into the top half of the box that opens up. Then click on Ask, or just hit the Enter key. There is a hand-raising feature there, but we do not use that feature. When you click on Ask, your comment does not go directly to the screen. Instead, it goes to an administration panel that I will moderate, and I will announce who the question is from and read it aloud, and then our guests will respond via the bridge. And I'll also type in OK, which will release the text of the question to the Q&A panel. Now, because of the way live meeting works, you will only be able to submit one question or comment at a time. Please keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And as Monica indicated, she is definitely interested in hearing your comments, any experiences you may have in your own community. We are ready to begin now. We've got a couple questions online already. This is from William Cummings. And he asks, should individual citizens and residents possess potassium iodide tablets and dosimetries? A NUDIP with an actual weapon, I don't know all these acronyms, really, sorry about that, an actual weapon device or RDD is not the same as a core melt accident at a nuclear power station, but last week on the 24th, both NRC and FEMA released updated guidance on the radiological preparedness program. And I guess I'll take that question a little bit more broadly and just ask you if you got into those issues at all and what your effort was, Monica.
I think it's important to point out, and thanks to Bill for bringing this up, the different radiological and nuclear incidents that are possible. So an accident or attack on a nuclear power plant, a radiological device, dispersal device, or dirty bomb, and then an improvised nuclear device or detonation of a crude nuclear weapon. And then a fourth incident, of course, could be a nuclear attack with a weapon that had been developed under a state-based program, certainly likely to be larger than 10 kilotons. So there is a spectrum of incidents that would involve radiological and nuclear aspects to it. And they have different challenges. The reason why we focus particularly on IND, the improvised nuclear detonation scenario, is because it is a catastrophic health event. A dirty bomb would have profound economic and social impacts. The health impacts would be minimal. So we prioritized the IND scenario in terms of needing to get information out to both community leaders and the wider public about what is the most important intervention in terms of reducing casualties. So that's why we focused on that particular event. And because, again, it's a taboo issue, it was easier for a non-governmental organization such as ourselves to go out on a limb and talk about this issue. We don't get elected, and we don't have to protect our emergency management budgets. On the issue of potassium iodide, in the IND scenario, where there's a variety of radionuclides, potassium iodide is not going to be protective. It has a very limited value, even in terms of the types of events that we saw at Fukushima. I'll stop there because I would have to defer to my medical colleagues on the pros and cons of potassium iodide in particular scenarios. I do know that it is not protective across the variety of radionuclides that would be released in a nuclear detonation. And certainly in a power plant radiological release that we saw with Fukushima, it too has limited application. It has to be taken within a particular amount of time. It has more benefit more protective benefit for children than adults. But I do want to be clear about the limits to my own knowledge about those scenarios, but I feel comfortable making those general statements. And Amy and Bill, I think there was a third component to the question that I can't recall, but I did want to touch those.
Looking back at it, updated guidance on the radiological preparedness program, dosimetry, I mean, I guess, I think you covered it. It's pretty much beyond the scope of what your effort is here, right, in terms of that level of detail.
Well, I think the dosimetry question is a good one. I think Bill was asking, should individual citizens invest in that type of equipment for themselves? Certainly that's a personal decision. We've seen some interesting sort of grassroots radiation monitoring being carried out in Japan in the context of people's distrust about what the central government was producing in terms of data about radiation levels. I think many of you are familiar with the USGS program, and did you feel something? I can't remember what it's called, but it is an interesting proposition to think about a population who, or a subgroup of the population that is equipped with dosimetry capabilities that could help fill in the monitoring picture. But I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you. And basically, we had the same question from Rick Powell, so we're just going to go ahead and move on. So I wanted to ask you, towards the end of your slide, there was that feedback comment about the, you know, it'd be nice if we had a clear federal message on this. In your outreach efforts, do you have any, is this going up the food chain, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask?
Yes.
Are you trying to, contact Congress or the administration or?
Yes. Yes, on both counts. We have briefed members of FEMA on the project and have gotten positive feedback from them on it. We also carried out a congressional seminar very specifically on the impacts of a nuclear detonation and interventions that communities could take to save lives. It was a very well-attended congressional seminar with a number of staffers present. Certainly there are members of Congress who have a particular interest in nonproliferation, and then those that nuclear nonproliferation, we had those represented in addition to those who have an interest in homeland security issues. Of course, it is a period of economic austerity. There are some people who really want this issue to advance. I think the issue of whether it's a legitimate issue to pursue has not been settled for some people. But the assessments are that this is a real threat. We have briefed various staff to members of Congress. We have reached out to FEMA, and we will continue to brief people within the administration as well as the practitioners out in the country.
And just a little bit of a follow-up on that one. Do you think the CERT, the Citizens Emergency Response, Citizen Corps, is that a potential outlet for you?
Oh, absolutely. And I think already the CERT training and has some elements of nuclear preparedness already incorporated into it, as does ready.gov. But there's some additional information that I think could be expanded to augment that training. The Council on Radiation Control Program Directors has put together a great resource that I would point people in the direction of, which is a guide to how one would recruit, train, and mobilize volunteers to assist in a radiological or nuclear event. There is, a scarcity of individuals who are adept at communicating around radiological issues, and there are ways of growing one's preparedness and response workforce by involving volunteers from different radiological professional groups through the Health Physics Society, the various medical groups that have a radiological dimension to them. So the CRCPD, Council on Radiation Control Program Directors, has put together this great resource about how one can incorporate volunteer radiological professionals into emergency management structures. A key platform being, of course, the Medical Reserve Corps, which I'm sure a number of you have units in your jurisdictions. And so I would definitely point people in the direction of that resource. It just came out about 9 months ago, and it's available online.
We'll look for it, and if I can't find it, Monica, I'll get back with you, and we'll try and get a link to that in the transcript and on our background page.
Okay, great.
That would be good. Okay, I've got a question from Ava Jean. And she says, we recently had REACT staff on, meaning on the AM Forum program, and heard about their work in Japan. Mm-hmm. Have you looked into the need for education on radiation within the medical community? If so, what did you find? I ask because the REACT folks spent a lot of time on this point.
Yeah, I would say that everyone in and out of government, in and out of the medical field, always needs a basic introduction to or refresher course on radiological matters. Some of you may be familiar with Steve Becker, who's a social and behavioral scientist who has done work on radiation incidents and following public reactions and the like. He was part of a rapid response team that was deployed to Japan after the Fukushima Daiichi crisis to, in fact, provide refresher training courses very specifically for healthcare workers around issues of you know, the safety of interacting with people and the like. So, you know, I defer to my colleagues with the REACTS group. Certainly medical healthcare workers of all stripes need basic training in and or a refresher course on aspects related to radiation safety. Radiation is a fear-inducing topic, even among healthcare workers. And so training is absolutely essential even for them.
All right. No questions online at the moment. Folks, please put your question in. We've got about 10 more minutes. One thing I wanted to ask you about, Monica, is, you know, you touched on the need for resilient communications. Is any recommendations on that included in your checklist?
Yeah, absolutely. There are several kinds of resources included in the workbook that are specifically about communications, both before an incident and after an incident. So we have the content of key topics that need to be part of any pre-event public education campaign written in plain language that people can incorporate. And as I mentioned, we have templates for public warning messages related to fallout and protective behaviors afterwards that people can adopt for use in their own communities. Another resource I want to draw people's attention to is the production of a guide of messages relevant to the first 72 hours following a nuclear detonation. Communication messages relevant to the first 72 hours following a nuclear detonation. This was produced by a federal interagency group. And it was meant to prime people, practitioners and officials, for the types of questions that were likely to emerge among the public after such an incident, or that and that included information that they needed to know, even if they didn't raise the issue themselves. And that is also available that I think we should provide a link to. There have been CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention support, been testing these messages in focus groups to also get feedback on them and improve that resource. But that is something that people should take a look at as well.
Okay, well, look for that one. But I really, my question, I wasn't clear, Paula.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Was going more towards communication infrastructure resilience.
Ah, I see, I see. You mean more from a hardware point of view.
Right.
There is some guidance in the checklist about ways in which one can harden communication infrastructure against the EMP electromagnetic pulse problem. I should point out that there is currently a lack of consensus among experts on just how the extent of damage that is possible through EMP. Some believe that it could take out things in a 2 to 5 mile radius, and then also have cascading impacts on the electrical grid and impact a very large geographic area. Others think EMP will be a very limited event, and that infrastructure, communication infrastructure, will be able to be preserved outside of the damage zone, the heavy damage zone. So I would recommend that people return to the checklist for very specific ways on how to harden communication infrastructure. More work needs to be done on this, and it actually turns a lot on basic research about, you know, what type of impact one can anticipate with EMP, because that question has still not been answered adequately. So there's a high degree of uncertainty. But yes, the checklist does have some advice about hardening communication infrastructure.
And presumably something about, you know, using alternate means such as the social networking and so forth.
Yes, absolutely.
Social media, okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, another question from Bill Cummings. He says, FEMA produced two versions of guidance to response to a nuclear detonation. And wondering if these are useful in supplementing the checklist. I believe the issue dates for January and June 2009. And we actually had a program on that guidance. I'm assuming that is something you reviewed when you were putting the checklist together.
Absolutely. In fact, several of the principals who were responsible, and Bill is right, there was a second edition of the first responder guidance around IND response that came out. So several of the principals who were involved in the creation of that response guidance were members of our expert advisor group, and many aspects of that, of those two documents, were woven into the checklist. As I mentioned earlier, this checklist was meant to synthesize and distill from a variety of current guidances and technical reports to chart a clear path forward for people. But yes, those were actually, from our point of view, excellent resources, and they definitely were woven into the checklist, and principals involved with their creation were part of the creation of this checklist.
Okay, I have got, we've got time, I think, for this one last question from Joseph Parrish. He says, you mentioned that 285,000 lives could be saved by shelters in Los Angeles with almost a 4 million population in 2010. Those odds do not appear to be very encouraging. Can you expand on this, or should the citizens in our second largest city be concerned?
Well, the 280,000 number, this is out of the number of people included in the dangerous fallout zone. So it does not take into account the entire population of the city, if I understood his question correctly.
Right, I understand it. I think what you're saying here is an additional 285,000 lives could be saved by these actions that would be lost in absence of these actions. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. Thank you for phrasing it like that.
Okay. I hope that clarified it. Okay, let's go ahead and wrap up for today. Once again, Monica, thank you so much on behalf of Ava Jean and myself and all our participants. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us and educate us on this issue, and we wish you continued success with your initiative in the future.
Well, thanks, Amy. It's always a pleasure to work with you guys, and best wishes to everybody out there in the field. And I hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving.
Yes, thank you so much. Folks, before you go, please take a moment to include any comments you may have, and complete our little relevancy rating form. This is a tough one, and I commend you all for taking it on. Our next program will take place Wednesday, December 14th, and that will be our last program for 2011. Please do watch for announcement and plan to be with us then. And don't forget, you can now earn CEUs for attending our programs, and details are linked from our homepage. Until next time, thanks everyone for participating today. Have a great week. We are adjourned.